I see normalization coming sooner than people think. I sort of fell in love with the country. And I've now been 38 times to Saudi. I've invested in a number of companies there and have found that there are just enormous opportunities. We're going to create huge, huge amounts of liquidity, of wealth. There are a couple of things that I think are going to change in the Israeli ecosystem because of this big boom in defense. One, a huge creation of job. Cybersecurity, the cybersecurity boom isn't going away. We now have a new boom. Never be dependent on anyone else for getting our arms. We need to be resilient and independent from anyone else. We can build things together. I'll give you two words that come to the top of the list, and that's Golden Dome. That's I think it's $1 trillion or $500 billion project. How much of the Golden Dome is going to come from all the work that's been done in Israel?
Hey, Lav. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, too. Have you had as interesting a weekend as I did as a news reporter?
It's literally never a dull moment. And fortunately, I get to turn my phone off for 25 hours over Shabbat. But when you turn the phone back on, you literally never know what you're going to find. And this week, of course, we found when we turned our phones on after Shabbat was the announcement of President Trump of the establishment of the Board of Peace, of its makeup, of a Gaza executive board and a founding executive board. We have the Davos conference this week where the board is supposed to meet for the first time. What do you make of all this?
So first of all, just to get to basics, because I think people are a little confused. Under this rubric, I guess you could say, or this title of the Board of Peace, there's the actual Board of Peace. It looks like it's turning into this broad, almost an alternative to the UN, which, you know, President Trump has invited leaders from all around the world to join. They can join for free for 3 years, but if they want to be permanent members, it costs $1 billion. And they're there's only a couple of countries that said they would pay it, although many countries have been invited. And it's not entirely clear what they're going to do, but part of it is supposed to be sort of settling international disputes, which a little off topic for us, but then it's interesting that he invited Russia and not Ukraine, right? Because how are you going to have a board settle the dispute with only one side to the dispute? But I guess there's a lot of pro-Ukraine countries that he invited.
If you get the letter that he sent to the world leaders that he invited, the language, it seems pretty clear that he's thinking about something that's larger than just Gaza, right? He talks about how this is going to be a bold new approach to resolving global conflict. It's going to be an international organization. He's definitely thinking larger than Gaza.
Right. So that's why it's supposed to be a sort of alternative to the UN, which at first was something that just like commentators were saying, but then Prime Minister Netanyahu himself said it in the Knesset. And it's supposed to be like a broader, but it's an alternative to the UN, but it seems like only in the sense of sort of resolving disputes, right? Like, I don't think that President Trump is going now to create all these humanitarian various type committees that the UN has, but I guess we'll see. He certainly hasn't expressed that, if that's the plan.
If you're President Trump and you're saying, okay, who's actually footing the bill for the UN, right? So the U.S., of the Security Council members, the U.S. is paying about 22%, or is assessed to pay 22% of the UN's budget. The only other one that comes close is China at about 20%, but then the UK and France are each assessed at 4%, Russia at 2%. And then from President Trump's point of view, you know, if we're paying for it, then we should, you know, we should be first among equals and we should have leadership. And then there's, why should we keep paying for an organization where outside the Security Council and the General Assembly, we have the exact same vote as, you know, teeny little countries that have less population than, you know, a city of the United States.
Right. And the U.S. just pulled out of 66 U.N. organizations earlier this month. Right. So also in this bigger announcement, and I think that the reason for the confusion is because this was announced all at once, was the Gaza Executive Board. Now, the Gaza Executive Board is also leaders and high-level diplomats from different countries that are supposed to oversee the Committee of Palestinian Technocrats, who will be overseeing the reconstruction of Gaza. And the issue for Israel is not really on the committee. There's an Israeli businessman on the committee, but not official Israel, but there's the Turkish foreign minister is on the committee, and a top Qatari diplomat is on the committee. So, you know, we all opened our phones after Shabbat to see the news about this committee. And then very soon after Shabbat, this Prime Minister Netanyahu's office put out a statement saying that Israel opposes the composition of the Gaza Executive Board. And they didn't say the reason, but it's very clear. And Netanyahu actually clarified later in his speech to the Knesset on Monday, which is that, you know, Turkey and Qatar are the problem, that Israel's not going to let them be involved in rebuilding Gaza because they support Hamas.
And I don't believe, to be honest, that Israel didn't know that this was going to be the case. I think that Israel probably objected to it, and just its objections were ignored or overruled because President Trump wanted to have Turkey and Qatar on the committee. It's actually interesting in terms of the UAE's role and involvement on the committee. First of all, they have their minister, Reem El-Hashemi, who's been to Israel, I think, more than once, who's on the committee. Nikolay Mladenov, I think I'm saying his name right, who's a very well-respected international diplomat, has, over the last several years, served as the director of the Anwar Gargash Diplomatic Academy in Abu Dhabi, which is this main diplomatic center and training institution in Abu Dhabi.
Before that, he was the UN envoy for Middle East peace, which is like a kind of useless job because the UN is not bringing peace to the Middle East. But he was very much well-liked and respected by Israelis and Palestinians when he did that job. I think that he was seen as somebody who is able to listen and understand what the sides want. And for Israelis, they saw him as someone who acknowledged Israel's security needs. So he's not the issue, even though I know a lot of people in this country hear UN and are automatically like, no way.
Oh, no, no. I think there are a number of people on the various committees who are truly committed to Israel's security and who truly do want to see lasting peace and security for Israel and for Gaza. I think Mladenov is certainly one of them. Look at somebody like Mark Rowan, for example, the chair of Apollo Global Management, who has done very important work in the Israeli educational system, building schools in Israel. By the way, Apollo's, I think, largest investor is Abu Dhabi. So that's another connection between Abu Dhabi and the committee that's been set up. Somebody like Arye Lightstone, my former boss at the Abraham Kors Peace Institute, obviously somebody deeply committed to peace in the Middle East and to Israel's security.
And Lightstone, we should point out, he is also advising the broader Board of Peace. So he and Josh Grunbaum, who's also on Special Envoy Steve Witkoff's team, they are the sort of diplomatic advisors there, which will be interesting. I mean, if the Board of Peace is some sort of alternative UN, I would imagine they will want to get, you know, I have a ton of respect for Arye Lightstone, and I often agree with him on a lot of things, but I think not everyone on that Board of Peace will.
There's things when you look at the overall, the various committees and the Board of Peace. Again, I think Qatar is very problematic, and Turkey is, especially their representative, is very problematic. But there are certainly people who I trust and I like who are involved in various positions. I do think, though, that, you know, we have the Board of Peace and the Executive Committee and the Founding Executive Committee and the National Technocratic Committee for Administering Gaza. The most important question of who, and this American general who's going to oversee the international stabilization forces, who and what is actually going to do the work of disarming Hamas, I think that remains unanswered. And the devil's in the details. Certainly when you're dealing with Hamas, the devil is certainly in the details. And it remains to be seen how all these various structures are going to lead to, in my view, the most important goal of disarming Hamas and preventing Gaza from becoming once again a threat to Israel, because none of us want to end up, you know, in another devastating war in Gaza in a few months down the road because Hamas has been able to rebuild its terror infrastructure.
So it's interesting. I spoke to some people involved in this issue. I mean, the Israeli position has been made totally public by Netanyahu, so that, like, you know, you don't need your special anonymous sources. But on the Trump side, when it comes to this issue of Qatar and Turkey, they said basically the Qataris and the Turks are involved anyway. They were the ones who negotiated the ceasefire. And while they understand Israel's opposition, it's sort of naive to think that they're not going to be involved moving forward. So Israel and the U.S. just don't agree on that right now. And I we'll see which side blinks first. But then the other thing that I got from my Trump administration sources is that they agree basically with what you said, which is to say, we put this board forward, but nothing's going to happen on the ground until Hamas is disarmed. And as far as the Trump administration is concerned, they said President Trump has repeatedly and publicly committed to the disarming of Hamas. Now, that doesn't answer our question about who's going to actually do that job, but at least from an Israeli perspective, it's reassuring to hear that they still see that as an essential step.
I agree. And President Trump said, I think, that they're going to sign a disarmament agreement with Hamas and insist that Hamas fulfill that. No, I guess it remains to be seen, and we'll have to keep tracking that closely. I think another topic that remains to be seen is what's going to happen in Iran, where it seems like the Ayatollah regime has managed to a degree to suppress the protests. We have yet to see American action. Numbers that are coming out, even the regime admitted that 5,000 people were killed during the protests. They claim that 500 of them were members of the security forces. Other numbers that are coming out by Iran International and other sources are talking about 16,000, 20,000, much higher numbers. Where do you think we stand on that, Lav?
Well, I don't have a position on the numbers. I assume that it's higher than the regime is saying. That's all I know about the actual numbers. But not long before we recorded, I saw some reporting, again, citing anonymous Israeli security sources, but still that they view that there's still things going on a low flame, so to speak. So not as widespread as it was before, but like that the protests aren't necessarily over, which doesn't surprise me. I mean, yes, a lot of people were killed, but I don't think that you can stop such a huge wave of protests so easily. That being said, what you see from Iranian diaspora figures is that they're very disheartened by what was ultimately a lack of concrete response from the U.S. They were hoping for something more.
I have to say, I don't buy the headlines, the New York Times headlines, that Netanyahu opposed the strike. I don't have any inside information, but first of all, it's really hard for me to imagine Netanyahu's made defeating Iran as his defining legacy goal, doing anything to dissuade President Trump from acting. But also, the reports that Israel wasn't ready. In the end of the day, Israel and the United States have largely dismantled Iran's advanced air defenses. Iran has not been able to significantly reconstruct those since the 12-day war in June. Iran remains very, very vulnerable. So yes, could Iran launch barrages of missiles at Israel and at U.S. assets? Yes. May there be questions about to what degree have all of Israel's defensive batteries and arsenals, have they been fully refilled? There may be a question. But Iran remains very, very vulnerable. The skies of Iran remain essentially open to the United States and Israel. And were the U.S. to attack and Iran to strike Israel, Israel would have quite a lot of leeway in responding in a devastating manner.
Well, I think the question is like to what end, right? And I think that reasonable people have different views about whether strikes would have actually helped the protests or not, right? Like the active figures, Iranian diaspora figures who are very outspoken, probably more of them are for strikes, but from what I saw, but some also there. But I'm also talking about, I don't know, like Neil Ferguson, who's like a conservative British-American historian, right? Like he said, he didn't think that airstrikes would do the job, that ultimately, and we've talked about this before, that ultimately it needs to come from the people themselves and they need to be able to organize it. A lot of people have said that, the Basij, which is like the domestic sort of security forces, like they would have to rebel for it to really happen. So in terms of like what Netanyahu said or didn't say to President Trump, like it's possible that Netanyahu said, maybe we need to do this differently strategically because right now when they're protesting, it's not going to have the impact that we want it to have, right? Like, I agree with you that Netanyahu is probably broadly for striking Iran, but I do find it plausible that he might have said to President Trump, like, doing it right now is not necessarily going to achieve our goals.
It's not going to contribute to regime change. I agree. It's true. It's a good point. What's also an important point is that the regime may have suppressed the protests to a large degree, the underlying factors that drove these protests remain. Rial has lost, I think, something like 45% of its value over the current year. Food prices have skyrocketed 50%, 75% in some cases. And the regime has no answer to that. And if anything, it's more economically isolated now than it was before the latest wave of protests. So even if they've managed to suppress this wave of protests, I think we're likely to, first of all, I think we haven't seen the last word from President Trump. We know the U.S., the strike, the carriers and the forces that are still moving into the Middle East. I think President Trump has shown his ability to surprise everybody again and again. But I think the underlying economic drivers that are going to lead this continued unrest and continued opposition to the regime, which impact a very, very broad range of Iranian society, I think that's going to continue as well.
You know, I look at the economic issue and people talk a lot about it and that how it was the sort of impetus for these protests. And I do wonder, because you look at Venezuela, right? Now, Venezuela was under a totalitarian, maybe totalitarian, I think less so than Iran, but still terrible dictatorship for 25 years, right? And it's probably less than that because Chavez took him a few years to consolidate power. The really, really dire, terrible economic situation is probably in the last decade or so. And they've been living in a situation where, like, you can't get toilet paper practically for years now. And then ultimately it was the Trump administration who came and got rid of Maduro, right? Now, in Iran, it's been 47 years, really totalitarian state, like in the style of the Soviet Union, right? And very oppressive of what you can wear and what you can read and what you can see, even more than Venezuela, a lot more than Venezuela, let's put it that way. But economically, they were usually okay, right? Like there was a large middle class, and I think the economic improvement in Iran started in the 1970s, like earlier, but it, like, you know, they were okay. There were times that they were better, right? So I wonder, like, what the tipping point really is, right? Like the economy is doing poorly now and the people are used to a higher quality of life and so they're protesting. But on the other hand, like Venezuela, again, they were able to hang on in this situation where there was no medicine and no toilet paper for a decade. So I wonder, sort of watching this, what the economic tipping point is for Iran. Will it be sooner because the regime is even more oppressive than Venezuela? Or because it's so oppressive, they'll be able to oppress the people even in a terrible economic situation? So, you know, I don't have an answer, but it's something to look at.
So moving from Iran to the United States, we had this really crazy story about the vetting process that the governor of Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, underwent allegedly by the Kamala Harris presidential candidate team. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So I'm interested in your view about this because I have mixed different thoughts about it. So Josh Shapiro has a memoir coming out, and he, in an excerpt that I guess the New York Times and I think also the Atlantic got to see, he talked about being asked what he felt were excessive questions about Israel, asked if he ever spoke to an undercover agent of Israel, if he himself was ever an agent of Israel. And he felt this was excessive. And he said, you know, you're not asking other candidates who are not Jewish these kinds of questions, which led to a lot of people, reasonable people, to reasonably think that this was somewhat anti-Semitic. The reason I have mixed feelings about this is, first of all, couple days after this news came out, we found out that Tim Walz was asked about his time in China, which is completely legitimate. And also, Josh Shapiro did work in the Israeli embassy in Washington for 6 months. So China is an enemy state, right? Like, it's certainly a very much a U.S. adversary. So I don't think that Israel and China are the same, right? Josh Shapiro didn't live in Israel for extensive amounts of time. I think for just like a couple months in high school, he was on one of these like teen semester type things. And he volunteered a little bit on an army base. People keep saying he served in the army. Like, he didn't. He volunteered for a few days on an army base, which is where you like do things like fold laundry and distribute food and stuff and sweep and like whatever. Like, I did those things as a teenager too, like for a few days. It's really not... Yeah, like you're not
a strategic contribution to the right to the
exactly. It's so that part is ridiculous. But okay, he worked for the embassy, and everyone knows that espionage can often happen from embassies. So maybe that's like so. This is why I feel like it's not as clear cut. But I also found sort of two things really interesting, which is that a couple of other Democratic sort of operatives have come up and said, yeah, I was also questioned about Israel in a way that made me feel uncomfortable when I was vetted for jobs in the Democratic Party. And then the other question that people are asking, which I think is a legitimate question, is if Josh Shapiro felt that there was anti-Semitism happening, why did he wait until now? Like, I know why, because he wants to sell books, but I don't think that's a good answer. So So what are your thoughts?
No, I think it really does come down to what he was asked. Meaning, if they asked about his ties, the current ties to Israel, I think that's a legitimate question for somebody who's going to enter high office. I mean, not in high office, but when I worked in the prime minister's office and I got security clearance, they asked me about potential, you know, whether there were, I had any ties with officials in other countries, and they wanted just details on that. I think that's it's par for the course. I think that if they were asking him whether or not he, as a governor, or even, you know, in his previous life, served as an agent, you know, a secret agent for the state of Israel, I think that is a certainly borderline anti-Semitic, you know, distrust of Jews. And the fact is that the many people who grow up as, you know, Zionist communities, committed communities, Orthodox, non-Orthodox, doesn't matter, but do often spend, you know, a semester in Israel, summers in Israel, you know, three, like you said, you know, a few days folding laundry on an IDF military base. It's part of like a youth program, not as part of, you know, serving in a foreign military. But that in no way impacts on whether they are loyal and committed Americans, certainly one who's reached the high office of governor. So I think that, you know, it really just sort of depends on what precisely he was asked. And to be fair, this is what I think, is that, you know, if I'm a, you know, the political operatives behind the Harris campaign, it may be that objectively, at that point, I have these fears that if the vice president is seen as too Zionist, that's going to harm the number, that's going to undermine or decrease the number of votes I get in swing states or key constituencies. And, you know, from the point of view of a political operative, they may be just crunching numbers and doing public opinion polls and saying, okay, this is going to increase Kamala's chances of winning or decrease her chances of winning. Now, that if that's the case, that is a sad reflection of the state of the Democratic Party vis-a-vis Israel and Israel's standing vis-a-vis Democratic audiences. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the pollsters and the political operatives were doing something that crossed the line.
Yeah, I think that you're right about, I think ultimately this answers what was a big question at the time of why did Kamala Harris pick Tim Walz over Josh Shapiro? And it appears, I mean, it appears that the Israel stuff just really bothered them, right? At least certainly from Josh Shapiro's side of things, like that seemed to be a big thing that bothered them. And that was, you know, a lot of people implied and thought that maybe that was the case. So ultimately, I think that's like the real significance here, which is that they thought that someone who has ties to Israel, and also they wanted him to apologize for, you know, speaking out against the anti-Israel encampments in University of Pennsylvania. And that was when he refused to apologize for that.
And really to his credit for refusing to apologize for that.
Absolutely. The whole thing is to his credit, right? Because I don't know how much it helps him politically to bring these things up now either. I mean, I still think he should have brought it up earlier, but he didn't have to bring it up at all. So there's that. And it tells us about some of the rot in the Democratic Party.
I agree. Well, this week we have on Mideast Horizons, Isaac Yitz Applebaum, the chairman of Kinetica Partners, the founding general partner of Mizma Ventures, really one of the leading venture capitalists investing in Israel, but also in the broader Middle East and working to connect those ecosystems. And we have a fascinating conversation with Yitz. But as we begin 2026, what's interesting also is that some of the numbers regarding investment in the startup ecosystems are coming out. So according to Startup Nation Central, Israel's startups in 2025 attracted $15.6 billion. According to Magnet, which is one of the leading agencies tracking investment in the broader MENA region, not including Israel, MENA startups attracted in 2025, $3.8 billion, which means that per capita, Israel attracted more than 250%, 50 times more than the broader MENA average. And to be fair, you know, looking at MENA broadly is a little bit inaccurate because if you break down the numbers, most of that investment is in Saudi Arabia, in the UAE, and in Egypt. And there's a lot of exciting things happening in each of those countries. And there's a lot of opportunity for connections between Israel and each of those countries. And Yitz will talk about that as well. But I think it is a real testament to the resilience of the Israeli ecosystem. And looking at positive trends, which I do think it's important to always look at the positive trends, something that's happening not directly connected to Israel, but I think is over in the long run positive for Israel. Just yesterday, the president of the UAE, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, paid a state visit, I think his fifth visit, his third visit since becoming president, and his fifth visit in the past decade to India, meeting with Prime Minister Modi. The two countries between UAE and India are rapidly growing the ties between them. I think they set a goal of reaching $200 billion in trade by 2032. They also talked about creating a strategic defense partnership between the two countries. And that's significant for several reasons. First of all, it's significant for Israel because of Israel's close ties with both those countries, including with their defense industries. We know that Elbit reportedly inked a $2.3 billion deal with the UAE this past year, just a couple of months ago. Israel and is one of India's major defense suppliers. You have the I2U2 grouping, the IMEC initiative. Israel, the UAE, and India are close partners. And as India and the UAE grow closer together and as Israel grows closer to both those countries, I think we'll see, and obviously with the United States, we'll see a lot of exciting developments in that field. The other thing that's happening also is the tension, and I think you wrote about this, Lav, between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. Arabia and Pakistan signed a mutual defense pact in September. So we saw UAE and Saudi Arabia clashing in Yemen. So the fact that the UAE is also now drawing closer to India and considering setting up a strategic defense partnership between the two countries, I think is significant for the region as well.
Yeah, I mean, we should do a whole episode on this sort of realignment that seems to be happening in the region, with the UAE and Saudi taking different sides after they were so closely aligned. But it's clear there's like a lot of really positive momentum on the sides of Israel and the UAE and sort of broader investments and growing startup field. So, you know, we should go to our guest who's the real expert on this. But before that, this is the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons podcast, where you can learn about what's really happening in the Middle East beyond headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Misgav Institute and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Misgav Institute, for those who are not familiar, is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international standing and alliances. And here on Mideast Horizons, each week we go beyond the noise, beyond the shallow slogans and the tweets and the posts, to bring you fresh insights onto the most critical issues shaping Israel and the Middle East.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And keep sending your comments. We read them. We appreciate them. So please keep sending them. This week's guest is Isaac Yitz Applebaum. Yitz is one of the leading investors helping develop and shape the ecosystem both in Israel and the broader Middle East. He serves today as chair of Kinetica Partners, a leading early stage venture capital firm investing in defense technologies in Israel and the Middle East. He's the founding general partner of Mizma Ventures, a $300 million fund that invests in AI, mobility, fintech, digital health, and other areas in the Middle East. He is a senior advisor to 8 VC partners. And beyond his investment roles, he serves as a advisor to the Minister of Communications, IT, and Space of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and is extensively involved in the VC and technology sector in the UAE as well. Beyond the investment world, he serves on the board of the Republican Jewish Coalition, where he co-chairs the Legislative Affairs Committee. He serves on the board of directors of the Asian Society. He is the chair of the Western Wall Heritage Foundation, and he's one of the founders of the Him for Her for Him Foundation, which works to place women on corporate boards of directors. Yitz is also well known for his extensive wine, whiskey, and cigar collection, which we'll get into as well. So without further ado, please stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Isaac Yitz Applebaum. Isaac Yitz Applebaum, it's fantastic to have you on Mideast Horizons. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start, you come from an interesting background, an Orthodox Jew from Brooklyn, the son of a rabbi, the grandson of a rabbi. I think yourself studied to be joined the rabbinate at some point, an investor in Israel. And now, among your many other activities, you're an advisor to the Minister of Communications, IT, and Space of Saudi Arabia. And you have many investments and many business activities in Saudi Arabia. Can you give us a little background? How does it happen? How did you go from Brooklyn to Israel to Saudi Arabia?
I'd like to think of myself as a wandering Jew. And you don't exactly get to decide, HaKadosh Baruch Hu helps you decide from where you start and from where you wander to. But I've been deeply involved in investing in the Middle East, obviously in Israel, since the year 2000 when I brought Lightspeed to Israel. And I've watched as the Israeli ecosystem has matured and has grown and has gotten to be where it is today. I participated, of course, in some of that growth as well. And when the Abraham Accords came, I expressed an amazing interest in what was going on in the Middle East, in particular, of course, in the Emirates, as they were the first there. But I was blessed to go on a trip to Saudi Arabia in 2017 with the Smithsonian Board. And I have to admit that the first place I went was to Al Ula, which is one of the most remarkable destination places in the world. It's a Nabataean, a 4,000-year-old Nabataean city that makes Petra look like it's your bathtub. It's just so remarkable and so beautiful, and everyone should visit. And I sort of fell in love with the country. And I've now been 38 times to Saudi. I've invested in a number of companies there, and have found that there are just enormous opportunities at the business-to-business level, and of course at the P2P level, at the people-to-people level, and worked my way bottom-up, top-down to really try and ingratiate myself into the ecosystem there, and that's how I sort of got to the position I have there.
In addition to the business opportunities, what is it about the country that you love?
Starts with the people and ends with the people. You know, they are warm, kind, understanding, focused, curious. I can't tell you how many Shabbat dinners I've done there. This is pre-Chabad, pre-anything in Saudi. People are just very, very interested to learn more. I'd say surely at the people level, at the business level, there's a lot of interest in what Israel does, what Israel has to offer, what the business opportunities are. And it's just very, very friendly. It's very hospitable. It sort of reminds me a lot of Israel, just a lot more capital and, a lot more access to market.
Once peace or full open relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia becomes possible, and obviously there's geopolitics involved in that, what do you think are the areas of highest potential cooperation between the two countries?
Firstly, I see normalization coming sooner than people think. Now, I've been bullish about this for a long time, and I've been sort of wrong most of the time, but I do think it's coming sooner than people think. And I did a position paper a couple of years ago overlaying and overlapping the 2030 vision, of which there are 12 or 13 principles: education, healthcare, technology, and then how can Israel help Saudi achieve those goals. And it's amazing the overlap between their vision statement and some of the areas in which Israel already excels. Obviously, the lowest hanging fruit is going to be technology. The Saudis have enormous access to markets, capital. They're innovative on their own. They have 36 million, a population of 36 million, but they're behind the curve. We've been doing this for 25, 30 years. They started doing this 4 or 5 years ago. And I think you take our ingenuity, our ability to see around the corners, our innovative spirit and culture, and you inject it into the ecosystem that they have there. And it's not a 1x, it's not even a 10x, it's 100x. So that's the first thing I see. An area that I know there's huge potential for collaboration. They have a lot of big companies. They have big insurance companies, big banks, big agriculture companies, big water companies. And if you sort of take what we've built and put Israel inside, and that doesn't mean that they don't know how to do it on their own, but you combine all of their resources and what they've built to date and add our innovation technology, it's going to take them to a different level. And I think that's one of the things that interests them most. If you look at what they've done in healthcare and digital health, They're far ahead of most countries in the world in their ability to actually work with patients using digital health and centralized hospitals and computerization. But our diagnostic capability and our ability to use AI in the healthcare space is far superior where they are today. And I think they can combine what they're doing. And of course, the third area where I'm doing a lot of my focus, but is in the whole defense area, the dual use, deep tech. We face common enemies, we face common problems, water, air, etc. And they're already talking to Israel, obviously, about these things, and there's great partnership opportunities there as well.
So as someone who's focused on defense tech investments, what other countries do you think are going to be really important partners for Israel in the near future? And I guess, what do you think that will do for Israel's international standing? You know, we've seen Israel be increasingly, maybe not isolated, but sort of criticized and in a difficult position internationally since October 7th, really. But on the other hand, it seems like defense tech is still booming.
Well, just to start with, I think things are getting better in Israel. And I think as things change in Gaza and you read something new every day, positive news, I think some of that will go away. But there, you know, there was a great piece in one of the newspapers I read recently, you know, who can be a bigger enemy of Israel than Spain these days, you know, when it comes to boycotts, etc. And yet they're buying material from us faster than we can produce it. So, you know, I saw a lot of the either boycotts or whatever Europe was talking about. But when it came to defense spending and defense investing, we've seen nary a slowdown in any of that. And of course, you saw Germany, the great, started with $4.2 billion and went to $6.5 billion. Just recently, you know, the big Arrow purchase that they've made. So I think from the perspective of what people understand, that the world is changing and defense spending, dual use is more and more critical and more necessary. And so we're the best. We have what people need. It works. And so I think that's one way to look at this. But I think people are very interested in not only just buying what we have, but learning from us. I've spent a lot of time in the last 3 months in Germany, in Italy, and in Japan. These are three very friendly countries to Israel. These are countries that are interested in resilience, that they have their common enemies or enemies that they need to solve for. These are countries that haven't had the need or the ability to spend huge amounts of money in defense in the last 45 and 50 years. And they're coming to Israel, they're talking to us, they're talking to other people with a thirst to learn how we build, what we build, how do we partner. And you take, I'll use Japan as an example, but you take some of their larger industries, you know, Mitsubishi, Mitsui, et cetera, and they know how to build stuff, but how much do they know how to build an early stage defense software? Well, maybe not that much. And they're logical and natural partners for us in Israel. The Germans, huge industrial base, Mercedes, Porsche, all those companies, they know that there's $300 or $400 billion to spend from the German government, but they know how to build cars. So they look to us, we partner with some of these people, they look to Israel to figure out how do you take their industrial base and leverage it to do more defense. So on all levels, both partnership, acquisition, spending, I think we're in for a very good period.
You've been investing in Israel since, I think, 2000, and you've been very involved in a lot of the most important trends in Israeli tech, cybersecurity, fintech, others. Now there's a lot of excitement about defense tech in Israel, and you are chair of Kinetica, a fund that's focusing on early stage defense tech. What impact do you think that defense tech is going to have on the Israeli economy?
So, you know, in our business, normally what people say is follow the money, and that's mm-hmm. how you make money. That's not what we say. We say follow the talpiot, folks. Follow the talpionim. Where are the smartest people in Israel going into technology?
Wait, maybe just explain to some of our listeners what Talpiot is, what the program is.
I think it's like the top 100 young men and women who join the army, and it's a program of 7 years where you do university, and after you finish studying either physics or chemistry, you then go into the different units, and it's really the elite of the elite, both physically and mentally. And many of the great companies, of course, there's many people in many units, but many of the great startups in Israel have come out of that group of people that graduate. But it's true for all the great units, 8200, 8100. So There are a couple of things that I think are going to change in the Israeli ecosystem because of this big boom in defense. One, a huge creation of job. Cybersecurity, the cybersecurity boom isn't going away. We now have a new boom, number one. Number two, something that we're seeing that's really remarkable, and I haven't seen in my 26 years investing in Israel, is when you were a general or a colonel and you finished in the military, you took your pension, maybe you joined a board or two, but you didn't really, I mean, there are exceptions, of course, really roll up your sleeves and get deeply involved in company building. That has changed dramatically. There isn't that we have six companies in our portfolio now. We see 50 to 100 companies a month, and there isn't one of them where you don't have a colonel or a general who just came out of the units, et cetera, who want to get involved.
Why do you think that is? Is it because they see the opportunity? Are they younger, perhaps?
Some of them are younger, but no, I think it's a, there's no question what we've seen in the last two and a half years with the war is people wanting to give and do and participate and make sure that this never happens again. So I think these senior people want to take their knowledge and use it in a way that can assure, first, we'll never be dependent on anyone else for getting our arms. We need to be resilient and independent from anyone else. We can build things together. But secondly, I think they have a lot to offer when they may not have had to offer a lot in a fintech. And thirdly, we're going to create huge amounts of liquidity, of wealth in the ecosystem. And, you know, I don't think they mind participating in that either. But I will say that they never come to us and say, oh, give me more stock options. Let's go make some money. It's how do we help? How do we build? How do we participate? How do we leverage what we know? And give me some stock options. So you'll have a lot more money coming into the ecosystem. You'll have many more companies getting founded. You'll also have the relationships, these relationships that we're going to have with Germany, with Japan, with Somaliland, for all I know, are going to help enhance what we're doing globally from a reputational standpoint and an interdependency standpoint. And of course, that's true in the Middle East too.
I think it's worth pointing out for our listeners also that the retirement age in the IDF is younger than in the general market. Like we're talking about people in their 50s as opposed to people in their 60s. And I would guess as life expectancies rise, like people want to have something to do also. And so good that they're doing things for the greater society. Things are so meaningful.
It's also fun to get back in the game. You know, you do these things. They're a lot different than being in the military.
So what do you think Israel's government can do to sort of foster a better environment for the defense tech ecosystem?
They've started with some programs, but I think it's very, very important. You know, I was around in the day of, what was it called? The original program.
Yozma.
So I literally was around in the Yozma days. And they were, the Israeli government was so creative, in particular, in figuring out how to bring in outside capital into the country. And believe it or not, even though there's tons of money coming in, everybody wants to be in cyber. So, you know, let's work with this cyber fund or with that cyber company. Israel's still nascent. You know, I recently wrote an article that there's been, you know, 300 plus billion or more in exits in cybersecurity in the last 25, 30 years. What's that number in defense exits? Infinitesimal. It's, you know, it's nothing compared to those numbers. And so there's still people who say, you know, defense tech, Israel, plus the fact people are a little nervous to get, you know, to invest in defense, a lot of the endowments and sovereign wealth funds. So I think to the extent that the government could help facilitate bringing in folks from the outside, I think investors from the outside will be very helpful. Also, it's important to figure out how to open doors. It's very different selling to the VP or the CIO of a bank selling cybersecurity, but to go to a government, right, be it the German government, the Spanish government, the Japanese government, and sort of make assurances and help make those things, help these companies gain market access, I think the government could be very helpful there also.
I think that's really an important point because unlike the U.S. government, the Israeli government historically, I think, has been much more reluctant really to open doors for Israeli companies. You know, I think people perhaps were being concerned that they'd be accused of having a conflict of interest or of acting inappropriately. And you have this sort of over-conservativism by the Israeli government and by the legal advisors who like to cause all kinds of hurdles. But I think at least in the United States, I know that it's very accepted for the government to actively push American companies. I think Israel should be doing the exact same thing. Yes, I wanted to ask you, you've been coming to Israel for decades now and been a very strong supporter, both on the business and investment side and on the philanthropic side. Where did October 7th, 2023 catch you? And what, if anything, has changed in your thinking or perspective on Israel or in your personal activities since October 7th?
Wow. So I was in shul at a Haredi shul and synagogue in Tel Aviv and actually didn't know about October 7th because there was no one coming in to take soldiers. You know, no one was leaving to go down to run to Gaza or to the south, and no one had their phones. And I went out to get my grandson to take him to shul. It was 11 o'clock, and something was obviously wrong. I mean, I was woken in the morning at 6:30, awoken in the morning at 6:30 by the missiles. But I was in Tel Aviv for all of October. I came in and out. I had some stuff to do in the Emirates, and the Emirates were still flying, as they still are today. Of course, they never interrupted. So I went out of the country for a couple of days. But I've been in and out of Israel since October 7. I don't know, 50 times, 30, 40 times. And I was there, of course, for the Iranian war, the 12-day Iranian war. And it's had a profound effect on me. Firstly, obviously, the level of anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism has changed the way I think about a lot of things because I'm a U.S. citizen now, also Israeli citizen, but I live in both worlds, and the worlds have come closer and closer and closer. They're no longer separate worlds. And I think that I live my life and the way I think about things as being pro-Jewish and pro-Israel in a way that I always thought that they were separate. You know, I did my philanthropy, I did my work, and I always did my pro-Israel work. And now I wear them both on my sleeve in the same way. And I sort of take offense at people and at things when they attack Israel. It's like they're attacking Judaism. And I know that there's differences, and I know that you can criticize Israel. I do enough of my own in governments, but the level of the way things have changed and the level of the heat, and it's coming from both sides, has made me and so many of my friends so much more aware. And the other things, we call them in a very beautiful way, October 8th Jews. It's awoken so many people in the Jewish community in Israel, believe it or not, right? But surely in the U.S., and I'm involved in so many more groups that I just never would have thought could have existed or would have been necessary to try and fix the bigger problems. So the problems have gotten bigger, the solutions have gotten more important, and we've come closer and closer. It's not just working harder.
So I know that you're on the board of directors for the Republican Jewish Coalition, and you were talking about the heat rising on both sides. We've seen really shocking anti-Semitism from people who are very influential in the conservative movement. What is the RJC and like-minded people doing to try to address and combat this phenomenon?
We haven't stopped from the beginning of this focusing on solving these problems in the most profound ways. Unlike many people on the left, they let these conversations fester and don't focus on them and don't attack them. Both the RJC, one of the things we've done is work with senators in a very, very close way. For instance, Ted Cruz, as an example, Mike Levin, Ben Shapiro. There are very, very strong advocates on behalf of fighting this anti-Semitism on the right wing of the Republican Party. And the RJC has been at the forefront and in the leadership of activating and working with these people and working with people in the Senate, with senators and congressmen, to make sure that they understand that our positions are 100% opposed. There's no room in the party for any anti-Semitism for anyone, and calling people out. At our convention, you know, usually at our annual convention, all we do is talk about how to be more pro-Israel, how to get more money into Israel, how to do programs in Israel, how to support senators and congressmen, how to defeat senators and congressmen on both sides of the aisle, although it's predominantly on the Democratic side, of course, how to defeat the progressives and the squads. I'd say half our conversation this year was around how to bring more young people into the fold, because the problem isn't really at the older people level. I talked to a senator friend of mine and said, and he's not wrong, what anti-Semitism in the Republican Senate or the Congress outside of two or three people? It's outside of the party. It's Tucker. It's the other folks. And we get all of our allies in any way we can to try and fight them.
One of the things that we've been thinking a lot about at the Miskav Institute is how do we both strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship, but also in a sense insulate it by making it so vital and so strategically important to both sides that it almost, doesn't matter, but almost regardless of who is in the White House, and of course we hope that they continue to be close friends of Israel, but almost regardless, the relationship will be so strong and so important to both sides that no one, whether a hardcore isolationist or a progressive Democrat, will really be able to undermine these ties. I'd like to hear your thoughts both on an issue that's been in the news recently. Prime Minister Netanyahu talked about it, the idea of drawing down U.S. military aid to Israel and perhaps replacing that with greater cooperation. But also, what do you think are the areas, perhaps areas that are not fully, we haven't realized the potential yet for U.S.-Israel relations, and with the right investment and perhaps the right regulation and the right government policy, we can really deepen and expand the cooperation between the two countries, say, in the coming 5 years?
You know, I'll give you two words that come to the top of the list, and that's Golden Dome. That's I think it's $1 trillion or $500 billion project. How much of the Golden Dome is going to come from all the work that's been done in Israel? And how do you make sure that that's the, I was taken aback by this rush of comments around, you know, taking the $10 billion or whatever the aid package is going to be. I think personally think it's a little bit too soon, and there's still a lot more work that can be done. But I can't believe that Lindsey Graham and Bibi are talking about these things without there being, okay, guys, there is something behind this. And maybe it's, you know, large scale projects around the Golden Dome. There is so many opportunities to figure out how to bring us closer into each other's orbits. So one of the ways to do this is to make sure that the Boeings and the Lockheeds and the other large defense contractors are doing more work in Israel and vice versa. You know, there's the offset programs. Most of the time, these offset programs don't really work. You know, the choice of last resort. How do you get early stage Israeli companies into the ecosystem, into the U.S. sooner? How do you get funding either from the U.S. government for in startups or partnerships with these large companies so that we're doing things earlier and earlier and earlier? And then it's no longer about buying things. It's about co-investment, co-building. Iron Dome, as far as I know, is, you know, was a joint effort between the two countries over a long period of time. That's one example. Maybe there's a second example. There could be 20 examples of that in the next 5 or 10 years. And then clearly, Israel doesn't need any more money from the U.S. because it's all going to be done bidirectionally. So I think that's one way to do things together. Another way is to make sure that we bring in and do it with other countries in the Middle East, where we already have a lot of overlapping interests. And how do we create these relationships between the U.S., the Emirates, and Israel and build something together so that there's a natural, the relationship's getting stronger and stronger and stronger. So the defense is going to be one of the biggest ways that we do these things together. But, you know, obviously in ag, in water, in energy, there are so many places for us to be partnering. We just haven't focused on them because that hasn't been where we've been led. But now it's a whole new world for Israel.
What do you think about this proposed shift from the foreign military aid model that we've had for the past few decades of the U.S. giving aid to Israel, which then mostly has to be spent in the U.S., of course, to one that's more of a partnership, joint investments, joint development of weapons projects? Do you think that's the right direction?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a question just of timing and how much, but absolutely. Right? Absolutely. We need access to what Israel, to what America has. But if we're building it together, yeah, unequivocally.
You've invested in many Israeli companies over your investing career. Is there a favorite investment, one that you're proudest of?
Yeah, I'd say one of my very best and most interesting investments is in a company called Orca.ai. It's a mobile eye for the ocean. But what's remarkable about this company that it has more data on the ocean, we think, than any company in the world. So they're on 1,100 ships, 24/7. The concept is collision avoidance, both at ports and other ships. You'd be shocked at how many ships.
It's like Waze for the ocean.
It's more like Mobileye. It's more like Mobileye, but it's Waze and Mobileye. But it can be used for environmental purposes. Don't go this way, go that way, because the waves are going the wrong way and you're spending more fuel. It's collision avoidance. It can be used for serious military applications. And it's a collection of, it's twofold. It's both running ships and making sure that ships don't collide. And secondly, collecting data on the ocean, which could be used by many, many different industries. Mm-hmm. And it's a company that's growing very quickly. As you can imagine, 2X Navy folks, and now run into a very big company. And the military is usually interested, and of course, commercial vehicles are very interested also. It has great applicability. It's a wonderful company.
I want to take a sharp left. You're well known for both your wine and your scotch collections. What would be your recommendation, one for wine and one for scotch, for our listeners who enjoy?
Well, we only have another hour left. That's not true. In the wine, I'm a huge fan of Flam. Flam from from Judean Hills. First of all, I love the story. Old man Flam, Yisrael Flam, was one of the original winemakers in Carmel. Just a beautiful, beautiful human being, and his whole family's in the business, and they make extraordinary wine from, low-end wine to high-end wine. But the Flam Noble is one of the great wines in Israel, and their white wines are outstanding. So if it's from the Judean Hills, I'm most probably going to go with them. If you're going in the north, I love the Matar wines. Also a great story, because Pelter is a non-kosher winery, and as opposed to going kosher, they built a whole second winery just to have a kosher winery, and they have their Petit Verdot. Some of the best Petit Verdot I've ever had. Great wines. And of course, if you're going to buy from the south, the Yatir Forest, great story, great wine. In the whiskey, it's a little more difficult. I tend to drink more high-end, slightly expensive, rare, hard-to-get whiskeys. But if you like peaty, smoky, I'll introduce our readership or our listenership to a distillery that they wouldn't know, for the most part, called Port Allen. Not cheap, not easy to get, but if it's your anniversary or you're doing, celebrating a sale, well, I don't know about an anniversary, but you're celebrating a sale, Port Allen is extraordinary. I drink from Speyside, from the Highlands, something called Mordlach, also outstanding, more sherried. Can do them in wine casks or in sherry casks. Those are two of my favorite distilleries where you can buy them in the shops and you can, really enjoy.
And of course, we can get your wine recommendations regularly in Jewish Insider, which is my day job, where I write for Jewish Insider.
Okay. Yeah. People ask what I do for a living, and, thank God I'm very busy. I say being Maxi Neuberger's wine columnist with the Jewish Insider is what
it's probably
what I like doing more than
fun.
It is the most fun, I'll admit.
Yitz, if people want to learn more about what you're doing, if they want to learn more about Kinetica, where's a good place for them to go?
KineticaVC.com with a K. I think that we're really entering an extraordinary period of growth here, and we've chosen to do early stage because A, that's what I know, that's where the action is, but B, there's going to be so much capital coming into the ecosystem. There's so much capital, there's so much being built in the U.S. today. We're close partners, as with 8VC. The largest investor in defense tech in the United States and maybe in the world. Right? They were seed investors and Anduril and many other great companies. And they all want to come to Israel. They all want to figure out how can we build something in Israel in partnership. And if you do that later stage, it's great. But at the early stage, it's where you're forming things. And so I think it's the best place to be today. It's early stage. It's always the best place to be, but early stage defense spending. And I think we're going to take a good run out of it and build some great companies and really help Israel a lot, which is surely one of the main reasons I've kind of come out of some sort of retirement, although I'll never retire, and really help to build this firm.
Well, we're looking forward to celebrating with you over some very good scotch when your investments pay off, and we strengthen both Connecticut successful, and as a result, Israel and the Middle East are successful as well.
First of all, you don't have to wait. I open great bottles because I celebrate waking up in the morning, which is no small deal for me. And I must say, I love the work you're doing, of course, and I'm very motivated and inspired by what you're doing. It's an important time in Israel's history to be thinking about what the future looks like and how do we involve and include all the things that you're doing. So I'm in awe of what you guys are building as well.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Great to meet everyone, and I hope I did okay.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org, and of course on all of Misgav's social media accounts. And you can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideEastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
See you next time.